The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
I wonder what your favorite television program is. Mine is Mystery. Miss Marple, Campion, Poirot, and above all, of course, Sherlock Holmes. And perhaps that's why when Larry Sibley invited me to preach on Genesis and gave quite a wide selection of options, I immediately gravitated towards chapter 6, because this is a chapter which is full of mystery. The first paragraph is one about which it's really almost impossible to be dogmatic. However, I hope we won't get bogged down in those details, the Nephilim, the children, the sons of God and the children of men, however interesting they might be. The first thing to note, I think, in the paragraph which we had read to us is the stress on corruption. The corruption of the human race. We've already seen in Genesis how sin has progressed and is the world, the ancient world, is careering almost, it seems, out of control. Whereas Cain was to be avenged sevenfold, Lamech boasts that he will be avenged 77-fold. But the corruption of the race reaches epic proportions in chapter 6. There's a new stage here in the development of evil. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they married any of them they chose. Now, what does this mean? Very briefly, a number of proposals have been advanced. Royal polygamy, polygamous marriages by rulers, but we've already had reference to polygamy in chapter 4 with Lamech in clear and unambiguous terms. Why the elusiveness here? It's been suggested that it's intermarriage between the godly line of Seth, focused on in chapter 5, and the godless line of Cain, seen in chapter 4. And this certainly has the merit of fitting the statements into the structure of what has gone before. But linguistically, there are difficulties. The expression sons of God is used nowhere else in the Old Testament, as far as I know, for human beings. Moreover, in verse 1, man, Adam, began to increase on the earth. That's the whole human race, not just one section of it. How could the children of men, therefore, be a reference just to the daughters of Cain and not to human daughters generally? Then there's the idea that what we have is marriage between embodied spirits and human women. Logistically impossible, it might seem. Doesn't Jesus say that the angels neither marry nor are given in marriage? And why, after all, are human beings then judged for the sin of angels? But the earliest Jewish and Christian exegesis seem to follow this line. Some of the intertestamental literature, perhaps also 1 and 2 Peter and Jude. We know that demons crave a body, and there's a close connection in Genesis between angelic and human sin. You only have to think of the fall in chapter 3, the serpent and Eve. We have to see the angels who appear to Abraham. And then, of course, later on in the New Testament, Paul can say that it's the God of this world has blinded the minds of unbelievers. And certainly here in Genesis 6, there's no evidence that what we have is rape. The marriages which took place evidently occurred with the full consent, both of the daughters of men and presumably their fathers too. Well, we can't be dogmatic. I myself have always inclined, difficult as though it may seem logistically, to this last hypothesis. Whatever it is, there's a quantum leap forward here in human sin. The violence, the anarchy, the rebellion, focused in chapter 4, is now taking off into new dimensions. I'm reminded of a terrible tragedy which occurred 3 or 4 years ago on the London Underground. A cigarette had been dropped into an escalator, and some smoke was seen to appear at the top of that escalator. It was smouldering there for some time. No one paid too much attention to it. But of course, underneath the tread of the escalator, a fire was beginning to develop. And then suddenly, whoosh, without any prior warning, flames developed, ignited toxic paint, chemicals in the paint on the ceiling, and the whole ticket hall was engulfed in lethal fumes, and 33 people died. Now, I suggest that here in Genesis, we have an analogous development. Sin has been building up, it's been escalating, and suddenly, whoosh, new dimensions of evil enter. Whether it is a complete breakdown of godliness in the line of Seth or a demonic invasion from outside, corruption has gained ground and from all human standpoints appears to be getting out of control. Now look at the response of Yahweh in verse 3. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not remain with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. Textual problems, of course, abound. This may be a reference to a time of grace. Judgment is rife, but it's going to be postponed, as it were, for 120 years. More likely, however, is a reference to the ultimate restriction on the lifespan of men and women. Drastic. If you compare chapter 5 with what occurs after the flood and see the respective lifespans there, you'll note, however we're to understand them, that there is a huge reduction, a massive restriction in the life of the human race compared with what went before. Judgment will fall. The Lord has spoken. The response to this onrush of corruption is a constraint upon the very life of man himself. And then there's another mystery in verse 4. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. Giants, as in Numbers 13. Demonic men, well, they're described later on in verse 4 as men of renown. But there's a continuation, nonetheless, of the liaisons of verse 2. The sons of God also afterward went to the daughters of men and had children by them. A picture of untrammeled wickedness, increasing violence and degeneration, life as if God did not exist. Quantum leap forward in godlessness. It's reminiscent in a sense, or shall not reminiscent, but a pre-echo of what Paul was to say in Romans 1. He talks about the human race living in godlessness and unrighteousness, and says that as a response, as a consequence of that, God gave them up. He gave them up to idolatry. He gave them up to immorality. He gave them up to disorder and anarchy and a reprobate mind. The judgment of God fell upon the human race as a consequence of their persistent continuation in unbelief and rebellion. Corruption. Then in verses 5 through 7, judgment. judgment. Someone might say or think, in response to the dark deeds of that first paragraph, 1 through 4, aren't things out of control? How much further can everything go? Has God lost control? Now, that might be a kind of response which many people might have. And today, although I hesitate to say that today's world is anywhere near as evil as what this pre-flood world is described here in Genesis, there are many who are thinking, has God lost control? 250,000 Kurds trying to escape unavailingly from Iraq. Thousands, millions on the verge of starvation in Ethiopia and the Sudan. Talk to people in Kuwait who've had their homes destroyed, their wives or daughters ravaged, their infrastructure ruined. It's all very well for us to sit here in comfort in the West. Many in the world have their lives thrown upside down almost daily. And the natural question to ask is this: is God still in control? A question just as relevant as it might have been back then. Now look what this paragraph says. Verse 5, the Lord saw how great man's wickedness had become. Verse 6, the Lord was grieved or regretted that he had made man on the earth. And verse 7, the Lord said, he decided. He is in charge. Despite or not despite, in whatever the situation, this mess which men and women had made of the world, he is still in charge. He is the primary actor. He is the one who sees and who decides. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh, as the psalmist put it. He saw all that he had made, and it was very good. His creation was perfect. Here, verse 5, he saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become. A change has taken place. Sin has entered. Not outside his decree, of course, but a change has occurred. Things are different now. God made things very good. We ruined it. Exceedingly good. Very wicked. And as he sees, he considers this state of affairs long established, a condition which requires a decision. He sees that every inclination of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil all the time. It's universal, the whole human race. No one is excepted. It's continuous, it's all the time. There's no escape from sin. There's no escape from the wickedness and evil which we have brought in. And it's intensive. It's the thoughts of the heart, the very root of our being. The evil deeds described in verse 2 are the consequence of the evil heart. Here in verse 5, the picture is black. There's not a shaft of light to lift the gloom. This is God's diagnosis of the human condition. Yes, it's been taken to an extreme, but at root it's been there from the start, from the fall. And this is simply an outworking of what is there endemically in the human heart ever since the fall. The flood didn't change it. Noah, his sons, and their children, they weren't exempt from this condition simply because they were spared the ravages of the destruction which took place. This was God's diagnosis on the situation then, and it's still a diagnosis now. No change has taken place principially to change this. The Lord sees. He sees your wickedness and mine. He sees our thoughts and our hearts as he did then. Secondly, the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth. It's a bitter pun here on Lamech's statement in chapter 5, his hopeful statement about Noah. He was grieved, he regretted he'd made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. He felt bitterly indignant. He was outraged. A mixture of regret and outrage, intense emotion. Just as Dinah's brothers later were outraged after she was raped. The heart of man is evil, verse 5. The heart of God is outraged, verse 6. Human sin, we may say, has an effect upon the heart of God himself. He is not unconcerned. A world of anarchy and godlessness is not something indifferent to him. He is personal. He is the living God. He's not cold, detached, dispassionate, impartial, neutral. See, a judge, God is a judge. He judges the world. But you see, the great weakness in our thinking and becoming preoccupied with that facet is this: a judge, a human judge, makes his pronouncement on a legal case before him. He folds his hands, he goes home, he reads the paper, he talks to his wife, he watches a baseball match. And the effects of what has happened there in the court, all other things being equal, has no direct personal bearing upon him. He's paid, you may say, properly speaking, to be dispassionate. God is not like that. He is personal. He is not cold, dispassionate, and neutral. He regards man's sin with grief. The Westminster Confession says that God is without body parts and passions. But if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, common usage of the word passions in the 17th century was a spatial one. Talk about the passions of a parallelogram. Body parts and passions then can quite equally be, quite legitimately be a description of the fact that God is not bounded, circumscribed, without spatial or geometric parts. But the God of the Bible is a God who is deeply, deeply concerned with your sin and mine, as he was with the sin of the world before Noah. He who did not spare his own son. That's redolent with emotion and with personal costliness. The Lord regretted. Verse 7, the Lord decides. He decides, I will make wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth. Just like wiping a blackboard clear of the chalk marks, or erasing records, erasing files from your hard disk. They're gone. He decides to act in judgment, to destroy sin and the sinner. And the beasts, they suffer too because of human sin. Creation itself is caught up into this terrible situation. The wages of sin is death. And the wages of sin is the judgment of God. There is an unbreakable connection there, right from the word go. The day you eat the fruit of that tree, you shall surely die. It's appointed to men once to die. And after that, the judgment. The reality is inescapable, however much it may be distasteful in theological circles today. There is a cord, a metaphorical cord connecting the two. Human sin and the judgment of God. And if you take a pair of metaphorical scissors and snap that cord and break that connection, you've torn one of the central core principles out of the heart of the Bible. Ultimate judgment is certain. The wages of sin is death. And here, in connection with this radical development of sin, this new dimension of evil, there is judgment. Sin and death. Sin, death, and judgment. God's holy response is to destroy both sin and the sinner. The whole of our life, then, including the study of theology as we go back to our lectures and to our books, surely must be lived in the light of this, that we live before a God who is holy, who sees and knows our very heart, who is deeply affected by our own sinful thoughts, a God who will judge the world. But finally, verse 8, there's grace. Because if that was all there was to say, we wouldn't be here to say it, would we? Verse 8, but Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. One man only. The background is chilling. It's desperate. But there's one man upon whom God's favor rests. It wasn't he was just the best of a bad generation. He's described in verse 9 as righteous, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. His life as a whole, was lived in the sight of God. And his household, of course, will be delivered, as we know, because of their solidarity with him. The creation itself will be spared because of Noah and because of God's grace through Noah. In the midst, then, of a crushing catastrophe to come, and in the midst of the incorrigible wickedness of his contemporaries, Noah finds grace. Indeed, even the consonants of the verbs in verses 6 and 7, regret and wipe out, are allusions to Noah's own name. Even God's judgment is tinged with grace. Even this crushing catastrophe which is to come has, as it were, some beams of light displayed in silhouette. God's judgment is lined with grace. His terrifying judgment on creation nonetheless holds out hope for the future. And I'm sure you're struck by how in the New Testament, Peter particularly focuses upon the relationship of the judgment God is bringing about here in Noah with the final judgment at the end of the world. There are close parallels. The whole world stands under the judgment of God. But there's one man who is righteous, and one man who finds favor with God. One man who's obedient and blameless and righteous, who walks with God every step of his life. One man, Jesus Christ. And there's deliverance in solidarity with him. Deliverance through him. Deliverance for us as individuals, for our households, for creation itself. In him all things were created. He sustains all things and is head over all things for the church. And so this crashing catastrophe displays in the tremendous pre-echo the mystery, the greater mystery of the cross. Yes, the Nephilim, the sons of God, the children of men, and the obscure incidents to which allusion is made there will fascinate people for centuries to come. But for those of us who like detective stories and want to solve unsolved riddles, we must beware that there is something far greater in this passage. I speak colloquially, a mystery of God's grace. Why should he, when we have made such a mess of the world and you and I have shared in that, why should he nevertheless spare us? Why should we find favor? Are we any better than anyone else? No, our salvation must be seen in its stark, against its stark backcloth, the inescapable connection between sin and death and judgment.